Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN has mobilized an emergency team and activated urgent assistance to support communities affected by Storm Daniel in eastern Libya over the weekend. In a statement released by a spokesperson on Tuesday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres expressed his heartfelt condolences to the Libyan authorities and the families of those who had died. According to the latest figures, devastating flooding caused by the storm has claimed more than 5,100 lives. 10,000 people have been reported missing. UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths has announced an allocation of $10 million from the UN Central Emergency Response Fund to swiftly support people affected by the floods. At least 30,000 people have been displaced in the city of Derna alone, according to the UN Migration Agency, IOM. Briefing reporters in New York, the UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric said that the organization was working with Libyan authorities to assess needs and support relief efforts and engaging with local, national and international partners to get urgently needed humanitarian assistance to people in the affected areas. Libya is under the control of two rival administrations, the internationally recognized government in Tripoli in the west and de facto authorities located in the east, along with the country's parliament. One in every six children is forced to survive on less than $2.15 a day, according to a new report from the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, and the World Bank released on Wednesday. The findings show that 333 million children worldwide are living in extreme poverty. That's 50 million less than 10 years ago, but the report's authors say that many more should have been able to break out of poverty had it not been for 3 years of the COVID-19 pandemic. UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell said that the effects of the pandemic, as well as conflict, climate change and economic shocks, have stalled progress on ending child poverty. She called for redoubled efforts to ensure that all children have access to essential services, including education, nutrition, healthcare and social protection, while addressing the root causes of extreme poverty. "We cannot fail these children now," she said. According to the report, sub-Saharan Africa carries the highest burden of children living in extreme poverty, 40%. Globally, children comprise more than 50% of the extreme poor, despite making up only a third of the world's population. In Uganda, four historic tombs of 19th century kings of outstanding universal value have been successfully restored and are no longer considered to be World Heritage in danger, the UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, has said. The 30-hectare area, which is home to the tombs of the Buganda kings at Kasubi, was put on a UNESCO list of threatened World Heritage Sites after a violent fire devastated the monuments in 2010. A reconstruction plan was led by the Ugandan authorities and implemented in close collaboration with UNESCO, along with international financial support. UNESCO's Director General Audrey Azoulay called the reconstruction a collective success. "This is also excellent news for the entire international community, as our common priority is that African heritage is better represented on the World Heritage List," she said. According to UNESCO, the site is an important example of architecture using organic materials such as wood, thatch, reeds, and plaster. The site is also a major spiritual center for the Baganda people, one of Uganda's largest ethnic groups, and is key to the preservation of their beliefs and identity. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Good afternoon, listeners. I hope you're having a great day. This is our 4,111, I think, show. It is September 14th, 2023. I'm your host, Mike Adell. This is some, we got some tight scheduling today, so I want to move right along and get the Democracy Now! Episode by us, because it really is a we've got a tight schedule today, folks.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Libya, the mayor of the eastern port city of Derna says up to 20,000 people have been killed by Sunday's catastrophic floods, which were triggered by the collapse of two dams amidst unprecedented rainfall. Libyan officials say the true toll may never be known after floodwaters washed whole neighborhoods into the sea. On Tuesday, Libya's prime minister dismissed the need for international aid, though he said Libya does need help locating the bodies of victims who were swept into the Mediterranean.
We do not need aid, not even medication or equipment, nor doctors or ambulances. Thanks to God, we have 400 ambulances that took off, but we have a problem in retrieving the bodies from the sea.
Rescue workers warned of the potential spread of disease and appealed for more body bags. Many of Derna's flood victims are being buried in mass graves. On Wednesday, UN Human Rights Chief Volker Türk called on Libya's two rival governments to set aside their differences in order to coordinate relief efforts.
I call on all Libyan political actors to overcome deadlocks and divisions and to act collectively in ensuring access to relief. This is a time for unity of purpose. All those affected must receive support without regard for any affiliations.
The catastrophic flooding in Libya came as a new study found Earth's ecosystems are outside of their safe operating space for humanity. The report in the journal Science Advances warns of imbalances to a majority of key measurements of the planet's health, including biodiversity, fresh water, pollution, and the climate. Climate scientist Johan Rockström co-authored the report.
6 of the 9 boundaries are outside of their safe space. The 4 boundaries that we assessed in 2015 are deeper into the red, so we're continuing to move in the wrong direction. And this is a big concern.
Close to 800 organizations have endorsed climate actions beginning Friday, culminating in a march to end fossil fuel Sunday here in New York at the United Nations. In Morocco, search and recovery teams say they're frustrated that the government rejected offers of foreign aid as the death toll from last week's devastating earthquake nears 3,000. This week, French President Emmanuel Macron sent a message to the Moroccan people that King Mohammed VI had rejected an offer by France to provide direct humanitarian aid. So far, Morocco has only provided access to aid workers from Spain, the United Arab Emirates, the UK, and Qatar. Many survivors in remote villages have been sleeping outdoors since the earthquake struck.
We don't know where we're going to go, what we're going to do, where we're going to live. You know, winter is coming, the rain. You know, winter conditions, rain. We have young children. We have nothing.
The United Nations Special Envoy to Sudan says he's stepping down from the role 3 months after Sudan's military junta declared him persona non grata, something that's not allowed under the UN Charter. Volker Perthes testified to the UN Security Council Monday.
At least 5,000 people have been killed since the start of the conflict and over 12,000 injured. And these are conservative figures. The actual number is likely much higher. What started as a conflict between two military formations could be morphing into a full-scale civil war.
Some 20 million people in Sudan, nearly half the population, face acute food insecurity. 6 million are just one step away from famine. On Monday, leaders of over 50 international human rights and humanitarian groups accused global leaders of failing to take action in the face of atrocities in Sudan. Ukraine's intelligence service says Ukrainian forces successfully launched their largest attack yet on the Russian Navy's Black Sea Fleet. On Wednesday morning, Ukrainian bombers equipped with British and French-made cruise missiles struck a dry dock in the Crimean city of Sevastopol, destroying a Russian amphibious ship and a submarine. Elsewhere, Russia's military said its air defense units thwarted a drone attack over Crimea, while Ukraine claimed to have shot down 17 out of 22 Russian drones launched at targets in southern Ukraine. Here in the United States, a Senate investigation subcommittee has issued a subpoena for documents on Saudi Arabia's $700 billion sovereign wealth fund and its investments in the U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal is probing a proposed merger between the Saudi fund and the PGA Live Golf Tour. During a hearing Wednesday, Blumenthal and other lawmakers raised Saudi human rights abuses and links between Saudi leaders and the 9/11 attacks.
This week marks 22 years since those horrific attacks. Not only did 15 of the 19 hijackers come from Saudi Arabia, but in the years since, evidence have come to light, compelling and mounting evidence revealing that the Saudi government may have known or knowingly aided some of these hijackers.
Over the weekend, President Biden shook hands with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman at the G20 summit 2 days before the U.S. commemorated the 9/11 attacks. While campaigning for President Biden, vowed to make MBS a pariah over the assassination of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi and human rights issues. Hurricane and tropical storm watches have been issued for much of coastal New England and eastern Canada ahead of the arrival of Hurricane Lee this weekend. The storm, now a Category 2 hurricane, is expected to widen as it crashes into eastern Maine, New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia Saturday, bringing damaging winds and a storm surge that will coincide with spring tides. Members of the United Auto Workers are gearing up for the first ever simultaneous strikes against the Detroit 3 car manufacturers. UAW President Sinn Féin issued a warning to automakers Wednesday ahead of tonight's midnight contract expiration.
The Big Three can afford to immediately give us our fair share. If they choose not to, then they're choosing to strike themselves. And we are not afraid to take action.
The strike action would see workers suddenly walk out of targeted plants while others continue to work in a bid to, quote, create confusion. Féin also said the strikes could escalate to an across-the-board work stoppage by all 150,000 UAW members if talks do not progress. Auto workers are seeking a 40% pay increase, 32-hour work week, return to regular pensions, an end to compensation tiers, and cost-of-living adjustments, among other demands. So far, Ford, GM, and Stellantis, which owns Chrysler and other brands, have offered pay raises between 17.5 and 20%. Senator Bernie Sanders has called on the U.S. public to support the UAW to help, quote, create an economy that works for all, not just the privileged few, unquote. Sanders notes the CEOs of the Big Three have seen their pay increase by more than 40% over the past 4 years, earning between $20 and $30 million each last year alone. The three companies made $23 billion in profits in the first half of this year, an 80% increase over last year. In Texas, a federal judge again declared DACA, that's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, unlawful, blocking an attempt by the Biden administration to codify DACA into a federal regulation. It's the second such ruling by conservative Judge Andrew Hanen, a George W. Bush appointee. DACA will remain in place for some 580,000 recipients and continue to issue renewals, but will not process first-time applications. The decision prompted calls for the Biden administration to prioritize immigration reform and provide a pathway to citizenship for immigrants living in the United States. The New York Legal Assistance Group, known as NILAG, called the ruling inhumane and shameful and said, quote, it's unconscionable that our judicial system is placing thousands of people back into the shadows of this dysfunctional, harmful immigration system, unquote. The case is expected to end up in the Supreme Court. The International Organization for Migration has found the U.S.-Mexico border to be the world's deadliest land migration route.
The International Organization for Migration documented the deaths and disappearances of 686 migrants on the U.S.-Mexico border in 2022, making it the deadliest land route for migrants worldwide last year. The figure represents nearly half of the 1,457 migrant deaths and disappearances recorded throughout the Americas last year, the deadliest on record since the Missing Migrants Project began in 2014.
The UN agency said the true toll is likely to be much higher. Half the recorded deaths near the border are linked to the Sonoran and Chihuahuan deserts. The IOM called on governments to urgently create regular legal migration pathways to prevent further unnecessary tragedy. In Wisconsin, Republican leaders are moving ahead with plans to impeach newly elected liberal state Supreme Court Justice Janet Prusiewicz, whose landslide election victory in April gave progressives control of the court for the first time in 15 years. With her election, the court is now expected to restore abortion rights in Wisconsin and could overturn legislative and congressional district maps gerrymandered by Republicans. On Monday, Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss announced the creation of a panel to investigate whether to impeach Protasiewicz after she called the current maps unfair and rigged during her campaign. In a statement, the ACLU said, quote, "The attacks on democracy happening in Wisconsin should raise alarm bells for Americans everywhere. Across the country, we're seeing increasingly authoritarian tactics being used to disenfranchise voters and delegitimize the electoral process, from baselessly ousting elected officials to election denialism to passing restrictions that make it harder to vote," the ACLU said. And Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney said Wednesday he will not seek re-election in 2024, saying it's time for a new generation of leaders. The one-time Republican presidential nominee is one of the few members of the Republican Party to speak out against Donald Trump and was the only Republican to vote to convict Trump in both of his impeachment trials. He spoke to reporters after announcing his decision not to run for a second term.
Well, there's no question but that the Republican Party today is in the shadow of Donald Trump. He is the leader of the greatest portion of the Republican Party. It's a populist, I believe, demagogue portion of the party.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour, every Saturday, 12 p.m., where we broadcast the news that you won't find on cable. Ever wonder what Gen Z is up to? Have you heard of Generation U? Ever wonder why the old geezers are excited that something's going on since their days of living underground and avoiding the Vietnam draft? We cover these topics on the Abolitionist Hour, and we kind of give you updates on the front, whether it's Atlanta, Minneapolis, St. Louis, Kansas City. We'll keep you updated on news and information on the state of dismal prison conditions and why the Jackson County Jail is not just a stockade, it's a phone company. So join us at the Abolitionist Hour, only on Blog Talk Radio, 12 p.m. Central Standard Time. We'll see you there.
And from the plains of Wyoming, drunk men came hurrying through, while Britannia's Huns with their long-range guns came in through the foggy dew.
Back to the glen I rode again, and my heart with grief was sore, for I parted them with valiant whom I never shall see more.
Every Saturday at noon here on Radio Free Kansas, you can listen to Carl G. at the Abolitionist Hour. And now, we do have more time than I expected, but not that much. We'll have a musical interlude after this first hour of Law and Disorder.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we ask the question, is Donald Trump barred from serving as president again?
Constitutional scholar Stephen Rohde joins us to discuss whether the lawsuits invoking Section 3 of the 14th Amendment will prevent Trump from running again.
We will also examine the renewed militancy on the part of the labor movement in the United States.
We'll speak with Al Bradbury, the editor of Labor Notes, an organization that's attempting to put movement back into the labor movement.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court became the most conservative it has been in 90 years, with conservative justices controlling decisions with a comfortable 6-3 majority. So we can no longer take any constitutional rights or liberties we thought we had for granted. prior Supreme Court rulings that aimed at ensuring fairness, equal opportunity, reproductive freedom, and a participatory government, including for those who were not born into the favored elite classes, are now at great risk. Today, with the help of Stephen Rohde, our favorite constitutional scholar, as our guest, we examine two very important constitutional issues. First, the question of how safe is freedom of the press in our country today? We do this by looking at the new challenges being leveled at the landmark 1964 case, New York Times versus Sullivan, a case granting protection to a newspaper when it prints a libelous story about a public official or public figure, but does so without actual malice. Is that press protection about to disappear? And then we change gears and ask our guest about the currently much discussed question, flowing from the fact that former President Donald Trump now faces criminal charges for seeking to overturn the 2020 presidential election. The question stemming from this is, does Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to our Constitution, stating that any American official who takes an oath to uphold the Constitution is disqualified from holding any future office if they, and I quote, engage in insurrection or rebellion or provide aid and comfort to our enemies, does it mean that Trump is now disqualified from becoming president again? The Constitution does not spell out how to enforce that ban. It was applied 8 times in the late 1800s. Today, a number of state attorneys general and others are contemplating this question and in a few cases preparing to take the matter to court, given their belief that Trump should now, because of his actions on and around the January 6th insurrection, be disqualified from holding any future office. In fact, a lawsuit has now been filed by 6 Republican primary voters in Colorado asking just that question and seeking to bar Donald Trump from that primary or otherwise running for president based on his disqualifications under that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Well, we will ask our guest about both of these matters. Our guest is, of course, as I said, Stephen Rohde. Stephen Rohde recently published a fabulous review of a new book by Samantha Barbas entitled Actual Malice, Civil Rights and Freedom of the Press in New York versus Sullivan. Steve Rohde is a writer, a lecturer, a political activist who practiced civil rights and civil liberties law and intellectual property law for almost 50 years. He is past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and a co-founder and current chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, while also playing a leadership role in many other organizations. He writes book reviews for the Los Angeles Review of Books, Ms. Magazine, and TruthDig.org, and his articles appear regularly in many other online publications. So Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, guys, and it's so good to be discussing two of the most important constitutional conflicts facing us right now.
Oh, absolutely. And let's start off with the free press issue. In the book that you've recently reviewed, Actual Malice, Civil Rights and Freedom of the Press in New York versus Sullivan, written by Samantha Barbas, makes the case really that the New York Times versus Sullivan case was, well, just as important to changing the course of the civil rights movement as it was to freedom of speech. Can you briefly tell us why that was so?
Yes, this has been largely overlooked by some, that this crucial First Amendment decision arose in the context of the turbulent civil rights movement. This was a period in which segregationists had discovered a new weapon to both silence the press coverage of civil rights and to punish leaders of the civil rights movement itself. That weapon was libel law. Remarkably, numerous lawsuits were filed in the South in this period. By 1964, officials in 3 southern states had brought over 17 libel actions against various parties, primarily over civil rights coverage, seeking a whopping $288 million in damages by today's dollars an astounding $2.9 billion. Libel law then was very simple. It had not been constitutionalized. A plaintiff, even a public official or public figure, need only prove that a false statement was made of and concerning that person. The statements were presumed to be false under the existing law, and it would be up to the defendant, to the newspaper or otherwise, to prove that everything was true in all particulars. This was a serious weapon. It was being used to silence the civil rights movement, and it set the stage for this case.
Stephen Rohde, who were the parties in the New York Times lawsuit, and what claims and legal arguments were they bringing to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, in this turbulent period, Martin Luther King and his allies needed to raise money for bail money to support their campaigns throughout the South, and several supporters took out a full-page ad in the New York Times pleading for support and calling out the segregationists and their racist activities. So on March 25, 1960, the full-page ad, Heed Their Rising Voices, was published in the New York Times. It was a stirring and exciting ad, but unfortunately, it had several minor errors in the zeal to publish it and the urgency. The campaign made some mistakes. They had the students singing a different song when they were protesting. It said that the police came to Alabama State College to prevent demonstrators, but they never circled or ringed the campus. And the most serious in the ad was that authorities padlocked the student dining hall. It wasn't padlocked. Officials never attempted to starve the students into submission. Down in Alabama, where only roughly 300 copies of the New York Times was even published and sold, a commissioner of police, L.B. Sullivan, got wind of the ad. He wasn't named in the ad, but he took offense as one of the, quote, authorities accused in the ad. And he went to a local libel lawyer. They read the law. They filed a lawsuit. They brought the New York Times to court. Plus, they named four black ministers who had signed the ad. On April 19, 1960, the suit was filed. And by November of 1960, they were in trial. It was an all-white jury in front of a racist judge. And lo and behold, the verdict was for $500,000, exactly what Sullivan had asked for. The Times was now facing a huge verdict. They had to pull their reporters from Alabama and limit the coverage of the civil rights movement, but it set the stage for the case going to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Please, Steve, though, explain to us as well how that decision in New York Times versus Sullivan by the Supreme Court, how its legacy has shaped our current view of freedom of the press, making it such an important case.
Yes, the New York Times hired Herbert Wexler, a professor at Columbia Law School, and I am proud to say that I had Herbert Wexler for constitutional law when I went to Columbia Law School. He was an extraordinary teacher. In this case, he constitutionalized libel. He conceived of an argument to appeal to the Supreme Court that this wasn't about reputation and traditional defamation concepts. In the case of public officials, the law was allowing you to sue for slandering the government. This was seditious libel, something used in the colonial period in the Alien and Sedition Act, but which had been overcome by Thomas Jefferson and later cases. But now it was allowed to be used by individual plaintiffs. He went to the court. He argued for an absolute privilege, that even if slight mistakes are made and there are false statements, if they should be protected because public officials have a forum, they can answer the charges in the public media, and he went before the United States Supreme Court. On March 9, 1964, Justice William Brennan, one of my heroes on the court, announced a unanimous opinion gathering all of the justices to overturn the verdict against the New York Times and the four ministers. It reversed 200 years of American law and said that a libel action brought by a public official could not stand unless that official could prove that the publication knew that it was publishing falsehoods or acted in reckless disregard of the truth. There's a famous quote worth quoting today by Justice Brennan. Quote, "Thus we consider this case against the background of a profound national commitment to the principle that debate on public issues should be uninhibited, robust, and wide open, and that it may well include vehement, caustic, and sometimes unpleasantly sharp attacks on government and public officials." New York Times went into the law books. It's been cited over 60 times in Supreme Court opinions. Dr. King himself applauded the court for upholding, quote, "the freedom of the press and speech, so vital to those who are engaged in the struggle for full freedom."
Given the current makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court, is the holding of New York Times versus Sullivan at risk? And if so, how might this impact freedom of the press?
We're in a very dangerous moment when it comes to freedom of the press in this country for so many reasons. And one of them is a concerted effort to reverse New York Times against Sullivan. In 2019, Justice Clarence Thomas argued for a reassessment. Gee, why would a Supreme Court justice worry about public scrutiny of his role on the Supreme Court and want to have broader libel laws? In 2021, Neil Gorsuch on the court claimed that he was reassessing New York Times against Sullivan and believed it gave too much protection to the press. And Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has complained about the Sullivan case, that it serves as a shield to protect publications that smear officials and candidates. That's an echo, by the way, of things that former President Donald Trump said as well. DeSantis has proposed a bill that would leave the press wide open to lawsuits, including a rule that comments made by an anonymous source, which is really a common journalistic technique, would be presumed false in defamation suits. So there are serious threats to Sullivan. But I do want to add that when the shoe is on the other foot, right-wing press is only too eager to take advantage of New York Times against Sullivan. That was shown in the $1.6 billion libel case that Dominion Voting Systems brought against Fox News. When Fox News was sued for defamation, what did they raise in their defense? New York Times against Sullivan. But when enough evidence was shown that there was knowledge of falsity and reckless disregard, then they settled for $787 million. So it seems to me that segregationists tried to impede the civil rights movement in the past. Today, Republican politicians and conservative Supreme Court justices are seeking to eliminate Sullivan. The rest of us, through the ballot box, through our campaigning, through our activism, have to ensure that the press provides that uninhibited, robust, and wide-open freedom of the press that we depend on.
Well, this is Jim Lafferty along with my co-host Maria Hall, and we're interviewing Steve Rohde here on Law and Disorder. And Steve, let's now take a big turn and get your opinion on the highly controversial question having to do with whether a Section 3 of the 14th Amendment might disqualify or be available to disqualify Trump from running and serving as president again. In fact, just some days ago, the case of Anderson versus Griswold was filed by six voters in the Colorado primary. And it asked the question, is it clear that based on what Trump has done, that he is disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment? So tell us about that case, about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
Well, for a constitutional lawyer, after practicing almost 50 years, who would think that an obscure Section 3 of the 14th Amendment could change American history? In the post-Civil War period, the Union was very concerned about Confederate officials, former Confederate officials serving in government, and they wrote into the 14th Amendment a provision that any person who had sworn to uphold the U.S. Constitution but then later, quote, engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or have given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof shall be disqualified from serving in federal or state office unless Congress, by a two-thirds vote, remove that disqualification. Now, what people need to understand in all the tension that's beginning to be paid to this is not punishment. It's a disqualification written into the U.S. Constitution. There are several qualifications to be president, 35 years old, a natural-born citizen, etc. So this provision has actually been used at least eight times that researchers have discovered, primarily during the civil rights period. But today, now legal scholars across the political spectrum, conservatives and liberals alike, have identified the fact that this provision can be applied to disqualify former President Trump. They've identified these eight prior cases, and the Congress knew what it was talking about when it spoke of enemies. This was not only foreign enemies. It was written at a time where the Confederates, former American citizens were the enemies, and the congressional oath says enemies, foreign or domestic. Now, it's been applied more recently in our very era following the January 6th insurrection. Former New Mexico County Commissioner Coy Griffin was found by a state court to have engaged in insurrection sufficient to disqualify him from running for office. And now, as you mentioned, the organization Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics, which brought the successful New Mexico case, have now brought a case called Anderson versus Griswold for five Republican registered voters in the upcoming Republican primary. This is an extraordinary complaint, and I urge anyone to go to the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics website. The complaint is 115 pages, 452 paragraphs, 206 footnotes. That could sound intimidating, but it reads like a spy novel as it recounts what Trump has done to engage in insurrection and give aid and comfort to our enemies. I believe this case will work its way through the courts. I think it is a serious question of Trump's disqualification.
Stephen Rohde, would any lawsuit now seeking to get Trump disqualified under the 14th Amendment be deemed premature, given that Trump has not yet been found guilty of, quote, engaging in insurrection or rebellion, end quote, or aiding and abetting our enemies?
This is a popular myth currently being circulated by Trump, his lawyers, and others. A criminal conviction is not a prerequisite to disqualification. And we have all eight of those previous cases under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to prove that. It's a disqualification. You don't need a criminal conviction regarding your natural born status or any other status. So that's a myth. This has been enforced in civil courts by suing secretaries of state, as is the case in the Colorado case, or by various writ procedures. It does not go to a jury, and the court is able to consider all available evidence, which could include the report of the January 6th congressional investigation, which produced a 1,000-page report on these issues. All of those facts are considered, and the Secretary of State makes a decision.
Well, Steve, you've just made a compelling case for that, but from a political point of view, given that such a civil trial has not yet taken place, lawsuit's been filed, given that no trial has yet started, even though, as you say, it's not required, nor is any finding of verdict of guilty required, would not the American people think it was grossly unfair and undemocratic somehow to seek to use Section 3 of the 14th Amendment at this point in the game?
That's a very serious question and a serious problem the country faces. We've had two impeachments. We have four indictments. We have now a suit to disqualify him. I'm confident other suits will be brought. There are some who argue that the way to prevent Donald Trump from reoccupying the White House is to beat him at the poll. And I respect that view, and I think that ultimately may be how the American people must rise up and organize. But I also believe we are a country of laws, and the rule of law says, as it did with the two impeachments and with these four indictments, that to the extent he has, in those cases, broken the law, or to the extent he is constitutionally disqualified from running for president and serving as president, it is the duty of our system to raise those issues and to have them adjudicated in courts of law in this country. I come down on that side. I am concerned of the consequences if he is blocked from running for president. There are many, including himself, who are making inflammatory threats of what will happen, that January 6th was only a rehearsal. We have to gird our loins for that. We have to be prepared for that. But I don't think that's a reason to allow a disqualified person to run for president.
This case, or these cases, will no likely, one or more of them, get to the U.S. Supreme Court. What do you suspect is likely to happen there?
This is such a quandary and such a risk to the Constitution and to American democracy. The premise is that one or more secretaries of state have disqualified Donald Trump from being on the ballot either in a primary or in the general election, that there is a factual record that has been built to establish that he engaged in insurrection or rebellion, or, and it's a separate provision, gave aid and comfort to our enemies. When you think about that term, without the qualifications for insurrection and rebellion, does any sentient human being believe that Donald Trump did not give aid and comfort to the enemies of the Constitution in the lead up to January 6th and to all of his efforts to deny the lawful inauguration of Joe Biden. That is aid and comfort. He promised pardons. He gave well wishes. He provided all kinds of resources. So if a record of that strength comes before the U.S. Supreme Court, are all six of those conservative justices going to blink? Is Chief Justice Roberts going down in infamy by joining a majority to find that Donald Trump is not disqualified? Is there any decency among those to provide two more votes with the liberal justices to provide a five-court majority to uphold Trump's disqualification? That will be a constitutional crisis when and if that case reaches the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, and I can assure our listeners we'll certainly be talking to you again about that if that does indeed happen. You've raised again some amazing questions of great importance. We thank you again for being here with us on Law and Disorder. As always, it's been a real pleasure to have you and be able to talk to you about these issues. One last thought, Steve Rohde, please let our listeners know where they can find your work, because there's many of your writings which I think they would like to be able to read.
Well, I'm very proud to be a contributor to the Los Angeles Review of Books, LARB. You can go on their website. I'm a contributor there. I write for Truth Dig and the LA Progressive, and a simple search will find my writings on these issues and others. I consider this a moment for me to be able to exercise my freedom of speech. You at Law and Disorder and elsewhere are very generous with your time. I believe that a public well-educated on these issues, these cannot be left to judges and lawyers. These are issues every person in America should understand and should act on, and it's always my privilege to be with both of you.
Well, thank you so much, and we double down, and I'm sure Maria and I agree with your last statement as well. Thank you, Steve Rohde, for joining us again here on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small. By giving you no time, dead is it all. But we cannot function. We can feel nothing at all. They hurt us at home. They beat us at school. And they hate us when we...
Labor is the sleeping giant in American politics, but not so sleepy anymore. We're in the midst of a labor upsurge, one with promise of delivering not only better wages and working conditions, but the prospects of wider positive social change. There's a new fighting spirit in the land, expressed by this rise in labor militancy. We can look back 5 years ago to the beginning of the upsurges of teacher militancy in red states like West Virginia, Kentucky, Wyoming, and Arizona, where teachers struck, often illegally, to better not only their situation, but that of the communities they lived in. This upsurge has continued. Recently, we've seen the great success of the Amazon warehouse workers in Staten Island coming together to form a union, and the Starbucks workers across the country have done the same. Meanwhile, the writers and actors in Hollywood have been on strike for several months. The Democratic Party, which gets a lot of money from the entertainment industry, has not lifted a finger to help them. The captains of finance and industry run and control the Democratic Party. They make sure that Bernie Sanders did not get the nomination in 2016 or in 2020. the leadership of the labor movement most often supports the Democratic Party, explaining that they are the lesser of two evils. The late great journalist Glenn Ford called the Democratic Party the more effective of two evils. He would have cited as proof of this the Biden administration's recent intervention, which prevented the powerful railroad workers union from going on strike this summer. To talk about labor's predicament and their fight back, we speak today with Al Bradbury. She's the editor of Labor Notes and an advocate and practitioner of labor militancy. Labor Notes is a media and organizational project since 1978 that has been the voice of union activists who want to put the movement back into the labor movement. Editor Al Bradbury joined the staff of Labor Notes in 2012 after working with hospital workers as a researcher and organizer for the Service Employees Local 49 in Oregon. Al Bradbury, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
Very, very briefly, before we get started, just tell our listeners, what is Labor Notes?
Yeah, Labor Notes has been around since 1979 and is the voice of workers who want to put the movement back in the labor movement. So we got started when there were reform currents in different unions, the auto workers, the Teamsters, the steel workers, the mine workers, people who are pushing for more democracy and militancy in their unions, to cohere that into a larger movement, a whole current within the labor movement. And over the years, we have conferences, trainings, books to share strategies, but Labor Notes is all about building a bottom-up labor movement that's built by the workers who are fighting in it.
Well, thank you. Al Bradbury, when I was growing up in the 50s, union membership was much higher than it is today. A third of the private sector was organized, and now it's only about 6%. How do you account for that?
In some ways, that was an unusual window of that period in the 50s. There had been a burst of organizing in the 30s and tons of strikes. The most workers in U.S. history to go on strike in a single year was in 1946, right after the war. And there was this short post-war period when there was a sort of bargain struck between labor and capital. Productivity was booming. There was a lot to go around. And employers had been experiencing all these strikes, all this organizing upheaval, unwanted labor peace. And then there was a public sector organizing and strike wave a little later in the 60s and 70s. But right around 1980, the employers launched an offensive. Essentially, they decided to fight unions. And it was right around then that Chrysler asked for concessions, asked for, you know, a contract that was worse than the previous one for the first time. And many companies took that signal and did the same. Reagan famously broke a strike of air traffic controllers. It's often cited as ushering in an era of anti-union attacks. Like, here's a message from the president on down. And you know, we have a huge industry of anti-union consultants that employers hire to figure out how to fight union drives, how to scare and divide people. So essentially, it's because the employers went on the offensive. And obviously, globalization played a role, too, as they figured out they could move more work around, sort of play workers off against each other. It's the employer's fault. But we also have to reckon with unions' failures to figure out how to respond to that. You know, capital gonna capital. Like, of course the employers are fighting us. You can't deny that unions failed to respond effectively, to figure out how to organize new employers and sectors. Over time, you know, many of our unions, I think, got too cozy with the boss and distant from the shop floor, sort of accepted this role as an intermediary organization that was there to keep peace between labor and management rather than to really lead the fight against management, even though management was, you know, increasingly going on the fight against workers. And so that's part of why, you know, Labor Notes has stood for, we've got to build more of a fight. We've got to, you know, transform our unions to take on the challenges of an increasingly hostile and powerful management and, you know, figure out how to build up a stronger labor movement again.
Well, Al Bradbury, Jim Lafferty here. Yeah, and that seems to be happening a bit. That's what I wanted to ask you about next. Certainly in the last few years, teachers' union strikes, other strikes we're going to be talking about in this show today, there seems to be an increased militancy again. Public opinion polls show that certainly most Americans have a positive view, I think, of unions. But how do you account for this kind of, if I may call it that, renewed militancy and toughness on the part of the workers and the unions?
Yes, I see that too. It's an exciting time and in some ways a hopeful time in labor. I will say people have by and large had a positive view of unions for a long time. I think for decades surveys have been showing something like a majority of workers, 60% or more of workers, wanted a union in their workplace. The trouble was getting it. Yeah, I worked as a union organizer helping people form a union, and certainly that bears out that, you know, you run into some people who maybe don't want a union, but most people do. They want to improve their workplace. They want more power. They want better wages. They want more safety. They're frustrated with the oppressive way that their boss behaves. The bigger obstacles are fear that if you try to organize, you'll get fired, and hopelessness, the sense that, like, it's, we don't have any power anyway. It's just too big a task. There's nothing we can do. And so I think in the current moment, we're seeing some change to that. People are less afraid, partly because we're in a tight labor market. People see accurately that the boss needs you more than you need them. It's not as hard to get another job. You know, it's harder for the boss to fire you because they really need you. And it's less of a risk because, you know, there are many other employers out there searching. So people are getting bolder for, you know, because they're assessing the situation accurately. And people are more encouraged. There's a sort of virtuous cycle that builds on itself, that when you see other people exercising their power, you see somebody organizing a union or going on strike and getting something from it, that does give you a sense of confidence that maybe it will work. And so I think as we've begun to see some resurgence, you see people across sectors being inspired by union drives elsewhere, wanting to do the same, and it builds on itself. That's an exciting thing about the moment we're in, and that kind of cross-pollination is what things like Labor Notes conferences and events are about, to encourage that.
Al Bradbury, last month, the 340,000-strong Teamsters Union settled with United Parcel Service, UPS, just prior to a threatened, well-prepared strike. They won significant wage increases, abolition of the two-tier wage system, and thousands of new full-time jobs for their members. Talk about that, please.
Yeah, you really put your finger on it, that it was the threat of a well-prepared strike that is what enabled them to win so much. It really was such a clear demonstration of the power that workers have, the tremendous leverage that workers have, that when over a period of months of organizing an activity, the union made clear that members were really prepared to walk out. Wall Street freaked out, the business press freaked out, UPS as an employer did and gave in and forked over a lot more money than it had been willing to, you know, earlier in negotiations, because it didn't want to see a strike. And it's, you know, I love to see that, to demonstrate that, like, we're not as powerless as we might feel when we act in unison. Capital really needs us. The backstory to that, how they got there, involves a grassroots movement in the union, a bottom-up movement over a number of years to change the union's approach. They really had a sort of go-along-to-get-along administration in that union for decades, but a reform movement of rank-and-file Teamsters that built over years to push for a different kind of union, to push for, to say, we need to threaten a strike. That's the only way we're going to undo some of these concessions, and we shouldn't make any more concessions, and we need to, you know, put overturning them on the table and make it a theme. People, so over a period of time when Teamsters voted down bad contracts, the previous deal in 2018 was rejected by a majority of members, but the leadership exploited a loophole in their constitution to force it on people anyway. But people were really mad about that, and that propelled a reform slate into power. So a new leadership won in the union for the first time in decades, and with a really different mandate. We could clearly, you know, riding the momentum of people saying, we got to reverse those concessions, we don't want any more concessions, we're not afraid to strike. So having a leadership that was setting a different tone, but even more important than that, was the bottom-up organizing that had propelled that win, but that continued to fuel that contract campaign. So it really took thousands of conversations and actions at different UPS hubs around the country to make that strike threat real, to get coworkers ready to strike, and to, you know, show UPS that they'd better hand over some more of their millions if they wanted to avoid it.
Yeah, and now we have poised and ready to strike, of course, on September 14th. 150,000 strong United Auto Workers Union. As an old Detroit boy and lawyer from Detroit, I I know about the UAW and very much appreciate what they're about. Really, they have members in Canada as well. It's against the big three auto manufacturers if the strike does take place, of course. Now, those auto manufacturing companies, after all, have closed, well, 65 plants in the last, 20 years. And as your organization, Labor Notes Associate Editor, Luis León reports, and I quote, "The UAW top leadership and membership are in a fighting mood, the likes of which the UAW hasn't seen in decades," close quote. Well, talk to us about this.
Yes, and Luis Feliz León has been doing tremendous reporting. I would encourage anyone interested to follow him and read as much more detailed reports than we'll have time for today. But it's true. Auto workers are in a fighting mood, like workers around the country. And we talked a little at the top of the show about this changing mood around the country. There's anger over the pandemic. Many workers were pushed to take much greater risks on the job and also to work longer hours, speed up intensification of work during the pandemic while their employers made more money than ever and demonstrated a lack of concern about worker safety. And I think, across sectors, people are mad about that, and certainly auto workers are mad about that. There's also this confidence boost from the tight labor market, and there's a lot about current working conditions that makes people angrier than ever, too. The flip side of a tight labor market is employers are pushing everyone on productivity, longer hours, faster work, intensification of work. In the auto workers, as in the Teamsters, there's a union reform backstory to this. Reformers won a couple years ago the right to direct election of top officers of the union, something they never had before. It used to be that locals elected people to a convention, and then the convention elected the leadership. Now it's one member, one vote, and then the reformers won the election. So there's a new leadership after 80 years of control of really one-party rule in the United Auto Workers by the administration caucus, which is very entrenched leadership. There's a different and much more militant leadership that won the election a few months ago, the UAW Members United slate and President Sean Fain. And part of what opened the opportunity for that change was this corruption scandal that came out. It turns out that this succession of leaders of the administration caucus had been engaging in a disgusting culture of spending both union and employer money on themselves and their family, a really direct sort of the worst thing. But the problems of administration caucus rule also go much deeper than that. The problems were not just the people were enriching themselves and using union funds to stay in power, but that they were accepting concessions, starting in the 80s and then in the 2008-2009 financial crisis, accepting this tiered system where new hires would make only half as much as existing workers. And they never totally got that back. They reduced the gap a couple contracts ago amid a member rebellion after workers voted down a contract at Chrysler and they had to go back and do better. But people are mad about that. There's these tiers, and we see them in many sectors where people are doing the same job alongside one another at different wages. It's just wrong, and it makes people very angry, for all the right reasons. It's obviously bad for the new hires who are making less. It's not fair. It's bad for the existing workers who are making more, but now you have a target on your back. Why would the employer want to keep you around when they can pay someone else less to do it? And it's bad for the union. It creates division and resentment, and our power as a union is our unity and our solidarity. So tiers are a union killer, ultimately. So it's very heartening to see in the auto workers and elsewhere, a lot of resistance in recent years where people are saying, no, let's put these tiers to an end, equal pay for equal work. They're still the second-tier workers currently. They don't get any retiree health care. They don't get any pension. So one of the big demands is to get rid of those tiers. Among the other big demands are, job security is always an issue, but particularly now as the auto industry is shifting in a big way from gas-powered to electric vehicles, the union wants to make sure this transition doesn't displace the existing workforce. The union members have a first shot at these jobs, and also that it's not a race to the bottom, that they don't use this change as an excuse for those jobs to be, yet another worse tier, that those jobs should be up to par with existing standards. People want to restore cost of living increases across the board. That's another big one. You know, there's a lot that sort of people gave up when the employers were in hard times, but then when the employers went back to making money hand over fist, they didn't get it back.
I'm here with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty. He's the co-host with me of Law and Disorder Radio, and we're speaking with Al Bradbury, the editor of Labor Notes. Al, the usual way that UAW and management start off negotiations is that they shake hands, and the president of the UAW, Sean Fain, wouldn't do that. It's a nice anecdote. Will you tell our listeners what happened?
Yes, I love this story. Instead of the photo op where the union leaders and the corporate leaders shake hands to kick off bargaining, UAW President Sean Fain and other leaders from the new administration went to the plants and instead spent the day shaking hands with auto workers, with the members of the union, talking with members and hearing their concerns and priorities about for bargaining. So it's a wonderful, both real and symbolic move to show, that reflects the sea change in the approach in the union that this new leadership is taking. There's, I think all listeners probably all know the famous union song, "Which Side Are You On? Which Side Are You On?" And I think Fain and the UAW leaders are showing that they're on the member side for a change, that they're not on the boss's side, and they're not interested in, making nice and civility with the boss, that they're really taking a more militant approach and willing to build to a strike, and a meaningful strike. As a UPS teamster said to me that this year they were finally using the strike as a weapon against the boss and not the members. And that's the way it's been in the UAW, too, that there have occasionally been strikes, but it's clear that the leadership is sort of letting the members let off steam by having a strike rather than setting out to organize a strike strategically to put pressure on the boss and win better. So this time it's clear the leadership of the union is on the worker's side and not the boss's side, and that if they do go on strike, it's going to be strategic and meant to extract gains and really to exert pressure on the big three.
Yeah, Al, I do want to ask you some more questions as well about all of this, but one of them in particular, I wanted you to talk about a bit more, was AI. You know, there are a number of social democracy countries around the world that are taking the step of training their workers who they know are going to be losing some jobs to AI for other kinds of work that they can meaningfully do. And I wonder if there's been any demands of that sort from the UAW as the auto manufacturers turn to electric cars. It will take apparently less workers on a line to make an electric car than a gas car. Is that a part of the demands at all, that some of the impacts of AI be planned for and taken care of by the manufacturers themselves or not?
I don't know about AI. I don't know the answer to that. I haven't heard of it coming up, but it may be. But certainly there are technological changes. There are changes in what the job entails with these electric plants. But there's also just any kind of change. Employers will use an excuse to try to gain some ground. And the union wants to, it's taking that head on and saying we don't, these jobs should be union jobs. They should be subject to the same seniority. They should have the same rights and benefits.
What is a national contract campaign, and why is it effective, and how has it helped to shift the balance of power between workers and owners and employers?
A contract campaign is a campaign over a period of months, leading up to bargaining, leading up to contract expiration, to get members involved and engaged, to build members' confidence and unity. And it's especially important when a union has been so inactive, hasn't had a powerful strike in a long time, hasn't had much member involvement. You got to build that muscle. You got to show it can be done. And unions do that in many ways. You can start with, often you'll start with milder things that are easy to participate in. Like the goal is, you want wide participation. You start with something that's easy for everyone to do. Many unions will start with doing a bargaining survey, having meetings to talk about our priorities. What are the things we want to win this time around? What do we want to change? What do we want to improve? And engaging coworkers in activities that get gradually more intense. Maybe everybody wears red on a certain day or wears a sticker or a button. You might have rallies at, you know, off-site or on-site in the parking lot of your workplace or out on the street. You know, you keep turning up the heat. You might march on the boss to deliver a petition, whether it's about the bargaining topics or some specific issue in that workplace. Like, the idea of a contract campaign is you're, like, ramping up activity. And, you know, when you're getting close to a strike, you might be doing things like, in one union, people started hauling burn barrels to work in their truck, just leaving it parked there in the parking lot to say, like, we're ready for a picket line. Or, you know, recently one auto worker was conspicuously stockpiling ramen inside the plant to show, like, if we have to occupy this place, you know, we got the food. So it's partly to show your coworkers and yourself that you're ready, to get ready, to sort of, you know, build that confidence and get in practice, get your communication networks going, figure out, is there an area of the workplace where people aren't participating and how do we get those people involved? You know, are there gaps in our network? And it's also to show the boss your power, that you're not bluffing. Like, if a strike is what's going to make them give you what you want, you don't want to just spring it on them, usually. You want them to see the strike threat a mile away, that it's coming, that it's serious, and it's getting closer and closer, and they should keep, you know, give you everything they've got in order to prevent it. Because, like, basically, right, your leverage is that at some point the boss is going to say, stop, either, you know, before you get to a strike or once you're on strike, that it's easy, you know, they'll decide it's easier or better for them to give you what you want and put this to an end than to keep it going. So these are organized steps. You know, in a national contract, you want to have a national leadership that's, like, encouraging this and setting a calendar and, you know, and sort of, like, inviting people to all march in the same direction. But it's also a thing that's actually going to be carried out by people, you know, in 1,000 different ways, in 1,000 different places around the country. And so you also don't want it to be totally stage mean. It's like, it's an opportunity for members' creativity and initiative to shine. And I think in both the auto workers and Teamsters UPS campaigns this year, we've seen lots of examples of people, you know, deciding, well, what we're going to do is we're going to have a meeting at a coffee shop, or we're going to organize a rally at a local park, or, like, here's a fun slogan that we could put on T-shirts, you know, sort of bringing their own initiative to it. The other thing I'll say is that many unions have nothing like a contract campaign. In both these unions, this was the first time in a long time that there was a serious contract campaign that, you know, that the union leadership was trying to lead. But, you know, there'd be little pockets of people trying to do it, but it's certainly more powerful if you're doing it together. And, you know, there are a lot of unions that haven't had a reform leadership, you know, yet organize and take over, where there isn't much activity. You might hear that there's going to be bargaining. You know, you might get some kind of an announcement about what they're going to do, but that there isn't a lot of consultation, there isn't a lot of information, you know, and maybe you find out at the end when they tell you, okay, we have the deal, we're going to vote on it. And that is such a squandering of power. If our power is our strength in numbers and our solidarity, then the way we're going to win the most is by everybody being involved and engaged, you know, as much as possible.
All right. Now, in the past, the contents of the negotiations between labor and management have often been kept secret from the union members themselves. This has changed in the UAW, hasn't it? Talk about the significance of this, please.
It absolutely has. Both the Teamsters and the UAW this year made big strides in, you know, actually communicating, you know, having an even two-way communication. So Sean Fain, the president of the UAW, has been on Facebook Live doing updates, talking about what's going on, but also, you know, taking people's comments in real time, talking about, hearing about people's concerns. He went on there with the Stellantis, the contract proposal from Stellantis, you know, formerly Chrysler, one of the big three, and said, I'm going to file this where it belongs and put it in the trash can there on screen, you know, which is a fun stunt, but also, like, reflects that he and the members are on the same page. They're, you know, in touch about, you know, what's being exchanged back and forth and what they're trying to get to.
Al Bradbury, unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time. So before we have to say goodbye, could you please tell our listeners how people can contact Labor Notes and get involved?
Yeah, go to labornotes.org. where you can subscribe to our monthly magazine, sign up for our free email newsletter. We also have a lot of great books about how to organize, Troublemakers Union t-shirts, and we do a lot of trainings and events, both online and in person. So if you're a workplace activist who wants, you know, to get some guidance on how to organize or how to be a more effective steward or what to do when your union breaks your heart or how to connect racism in the labor movement. We have online trainings coming up and all of those things, and then a big conference with thousands of people coming together next April 19 to 21 in Chicago. Don't miss that. Labornotes.org for all of that.
Al Bradbury, it's been terrific speaking with you.
The labor is going to be very much in the press in the weeks and months ahead, and we're going to be coming back to you, I'm sure, to get your reaction to what we hear in the news.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been a treat.
Take it easy, Al.
Solidarity.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
It is we who plow the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving mid the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong.
That was Pete Seeger. That's an old classic. Here's an up one, a new one, that Billy Bragg put out in response to the hit The Rich Men North of Richmond. This is called North of a Million by Billy Bragg.
If you're selling your soul, working all day, overtime hours for bullshit pay, well, nothing's gonna change if all you do is wish you could wake up and it not be true. Join a union. Fight for better pay. You better join a union, brother. Organize today. You'll see where the problem really lies when the union comes around. Rich men earning north of a million wanna keep the working folk down. Wanna keep the working folk down. Form a union, you'll soon find that working people are all the one kind. So we ain't gonna punch down on those who need a bit of understanding and some solidarity. That ain't right, friend. If you're struggling with your health and you're putting on the pounds, doctor gives you opiates to help you get around, well, wouldn't it be better for folks like you and me if medicine was subsidized and healthcare was free? Join a union. Fight for better pay. Come on and join a union, sister. Organize today. Comes down to the silk, same thing if you're black or white or brown. Rich men earning north of a million wanna keep the working folk down. Wanna keep the working folk down. your culture wars are there to distract while libertarian billionaires avoid paying tax. You want to talk about bathrooms while the floodwaters rise. The forest is on fire and the wind burns our eyes. Something's wrong here. Well, they want to divide us because together we're strong. Are you gonna take action now? You sung your damn song. If you don't like the rich man having total control, you better get the union to roll. Join a union. Fight for better pay. Come on and join a union. Organize today. Don't matter if you live in the city or some little country town. Rich men earning north of a million. Rich men earning north of a million. I see rich men earning north of a million. Wanna keep the working folk down. Wanna keep the working folk down. Selling your soul and you're working all day, overtime hours for bullshit pay, join a union.
Billy Bragg, and this is one more Power in the Union with Utah Phillips.
Would you have freedom from wage slavery? Then come join the grand industrial band. Would you from misery and hunger be free? Come on, do your share, lend a hand.
There is power in a band of working folks when they stand hand in hand. That's the power that was ruined.
Mansions of gold in the sky and live in a shack way in the back. Would you have wings up in heaven to fly and stay here with rags on your back?
There is power in a hand of working folk when they stand.
Blood of the Lamb, then come join the grand industrial band. If for a change you'd have eggs and ham, come on, do your share, lend a hand.
There is power in a band of working folk when we stand.
Beat on your heads, then don't organize, all unions despise. If you'd have nothing before you're dead, shake hands with your boss and look wise.
There is power in a band of working folks when they stand.
Professor John Mearsheimer comes out of the University of Chicago. He's most unusual. He predicted the Ukraine war and the failure of it long before it happened. Here is a speech, a lecture, he gave on his official John Mearsheimer website on YouTube. It was delivered on the 11th of September.
So we really wanted to start off the discussion by focusing on where we currently are in this Ukrainian offensive. And you have a new article out with the title Bound to Lose, which is, of course, revealing, in which you argue that the big counteroffensive that we were arming the Ukrainians for was destined to fail. I was hoping you could elaborate and explain.
Well, I think that what had happened here, Glenn, is that the war had settled into a war of attrition. In a war of attrition, the Ukrainians were guaranteed to lose. The Russians are just much too powerful in terms of the balance of manpower and the balance of military equipment, especially artillery, for the Ukrainians to win over the long term. I might also add that there are all sorts of questions about whether the West would remain committed to providing weapons for Ukraine. So they were potentially in real trouble in a war of attrition. And what they were doing was looking for a clever strategy to get out of that situation. And they decided to launch what was a classic blitzkrieg, which is that they would try to penetrate or break through the front lines, the so-called Surovikin line of the Russian defenses. And then once they were in the rear area of the Russians, they would effect a deep strategic penetration. In other words, they'd drive deep into the area that the Russians controlled, and they'd reach the Sea of Azov. And this would split the Russian forces in half and put an end to the land bridge to Crimea. And then the Russians would be back on their heels. They'd agree to have a negotiation, and we would hold all the cards, we meaning the West and Ukraine. And the end result would be that we'd get a favorable agreement and put an end to this war. And my argument is that this was a pipe dream. This is not a serious argument. That's not to say that virtually everybody in the West, in the mainstream, that doesn't include any of us at this point in time, but virtually everybody in the mainstream thought this was going to work. They thought that it was going to work swimmingly, and the Ukrainians would end up defeating the Russians. And my argument in the paper that I just wrote, which, of course, you two have long agreed with, is that this was a pipe dream. It was just not going to work. And, of course, it hasn't worked. It's actually quite stunning how unsuccessful the Ukrainians have been and what a god-awful price they have paid. I mean, it's actually sickening to read the stories and watch the videos about the casualties in Ukraine. These are people who are being led to the slaughter. And in fact, the West was pushing them to launch this offensive. There's all sorts of evidence that the Ukrainians were dragging their feet because they understood that it wasn't going to work. But nevertheless, we pushed very hard for them to launch this offensive on 4 June. And it's quite clear where we are. So that's my basic storyline.
I think your article actually isn't, that may be the basic storyline, but it goes more deeply, because one of the things that is so interesting and I found so interesting about that article is that you look at the question of blitzkrieg and you ask, how often does blitzkrieg succeed in these kind of situations against a peer equal adversary? And it doesn't succeed very often. I think only one instance, which was, if you like, the original blitzkrieg in 1940. Now, this one assumes, I assume, I've not had much dealings with military people at all. This was something which I would have assumed military people in Washington would know. Did they know? If not, what caused them to get this so completely wrong? I mean, were they providing wrong advice to the White House, to the administration, through NATO? Or was it something that they just themselves got wrong, perhaps because they didn't take the Russians very seriously.
Well, the truth is, Alexander, I learned all this stuff about Blitzkrieg and armored warfare during the Cold War, when we focused on the Central Front. And the question at the time was whether or not the Soviets or the Warsaw Pact could launch an attack into Germany and end up on the beaches of Dunkirk in 48 hours. Now, very importantly, this was seen as a fair fight. You had two massive armies on either side of the inner German border. And we looked at the subject of Blitzkrieg in the context of a fair fight in those days. What has happened with the end of the Cold War is that the United States has engaged in lots of unfair fights. The United States is very good at beating up on militaries that are far weaker than the American military. And we have not been involved in a fair fight that involved launching a blitzkrieg. So you have all of these generals in the American military who comment on TV who just have not thought long and hard about blitzkrieg involving a fair fight, right? And they tended to think that this was an unfair fight because, as you emphasize in your shows, there's a widespread feeling in the West that the Russians are bankrupt militarily, that they're on the verge of breaking apart, they don't know how to fight, and the Ukrainians are on a roll, so to speak. So in a very important way, I think a lot of people in the West, and this includes the generals, thought that this was an unfair fight and that the Ukrainians could simply do to the Russians what the Germans did to the French in 1940. But anybody who looked at this carefully, looked at what the balance of forces really looked like, and I would emphasize this, listen to what the Ukrainians were saying about Russian capabilities. The Ukrainians were saying since at least January of this year that the Russians were getting very effective at fighting on the battlefield. They were learning, and they had a steep learning curve. So the Ukrainians did not expect the Russians to fold. But in the West, I think, especially among these generals, there was a widespread feeling that the Russians would fold and that this would be an unfair fight in the end. And of course, they were dead wrong. The other point I would make is that it is virtually impossible for anyone who wants to be accepted in the mainstream in the United States to make the argument that the Ukrainians are doomed and that the Russians have the upper hand. The discourse in the West, and this includes the United States and Europe, goes in a way that says the Russians are bankrupt, the Russians are evil, the Russians are going to lose, the Ukrainians are the good guys, and so forth and so on. And if you challenge that conventional wisdom, you're in serious trouble. You're either called a Putin apologist or you're basically blackballed and not allowed to write op-eds or articles in the mainstream media. And it's very effective. So if you're a general officer or you're a pundit or you're a strategist and you want to comment on what Ukraine's likelihood is of winning against the Russians, you better say that the Ukrainians are going to win. And if you say the Ukrainians are doomed, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. And that incentive structure, I think, explains a lot of what is going on here.
I wanted to ask, do you think also we to some extent began to believe some of our own information warfare or propaganda? Because I think many people wanted to repeat what was done in Kherson and Kharkov, but because in the our media, it's portrayed as being this great big battles and huge victories for Ukraine. But again, if we look at it, I guess, you know, the Battle of Kherson was, you know, the Russian had to pull back because they feared that all the rear was vulnerable, that the Ukrainians could take out the dam or the bridges so they wouldn't be able to retreat. And we had the same force structure of the Russians in Kharkov when they were very, you know, they didn't have that many troops back then in the middle of 2022, so a very limited ability to defend such a huge territory. So they also did what you can call a tactical withdrawal. But again, in our media, it was, you know, a great battle victory. It proved, you know, that one side was competent, the other one was a failure. And but of course, the military has changed. We're not fighting Russia of the summer of 2022. We're fighting in September of 2023. How do you see the Russian capabilities and their intention having changed over the past year?
Well, two quick points. One is, I think we misread what happened. We, meaning the West, the mainstream media, misread what happened in Kharkiv and Kherson, as you described it. And if you looked carefully at what happened, these were not great Ukrainian victories. In fact, if you go to Kherson, as both of you know very well, before the Russians withdrew, they really hammered the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians suffered enormous casualties on the west bank of Kherson, on the west bank of the Dnieper in Kherson, before the Russians evacuated. The Russians were not pushed out, right? And you see a similar situation in Kharkiv. So these were not great victories that, you know, presaged what was going to happen in the counteroffensive. The counteroffensive, the situation that the Ukrainians were facing in the counteroffensive was fundamentally different than the situation they faced in those two big campaigns in 2022. And people just misread this. But look, here's what happened. First of all, the Russians learned. And this is a lot like World War II. If you look at the Red Army in July of 1941, it does not look very competent. And indeed, it is not very competent. But if you look at the Red Army in July of 1944, it's a fundamentally different army. It is much more competent. And we all know how that war started out and how it ended. So the Russians had a steep learning curve. And this is not peculiar to the Russian army. All armies start off rusty, and then they improve as the war goes on. Just look at what happened to the American army in World War II. We performed horribly in North Africa when we first landed there, the Battle of Kasserine Pass. It was a disaster. But slowly but steadily, we learned. And by the time, you know, we had to break out at San Lo in the summer of 1944, we were a quite competent army. So the Russians were going to get better, period. And again, the Ukrainians were telling us that that was happening. That's point number one. Point number two is that the Russians mobilized lots of forces. And now they have lots of people who are enlisting in the army. And this is a growing army. It's getting bigger and bigger. It's suffering much less casualties than the Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. And the end result of this is that the Russian army has gotten much more formidable relative to the Ukrainian army over time. And this, from a Ukrainian point of view, this situation only gets worse because the Russian army is going to get bigger and bigger. The Ukrainian army has been badly damaged. It's really quite amazing the casualties they've suffered, not only in terms of manpower, but in terms of weaponry as well. So this is, I think, basically what's happened here.
I mean, the Russians have clearly been on a massive learning curve. The question is, what about us? Are we going through a learning curve ourselves? I mean, we've supported Ukraine. We pushed Ukraine into this offensive. The offensive is not turning out well. Are we learning any lessons from it here in the West? Are we starting to absorb some of the military lessons, but perhaps more importantly, some of the political lessons? I say that because I read all the time in the media arguments about tactics, about the fact that Ukraine needs to change its tactics, go on to combined arms tactics. I've never really understood much of this, not having any sort of military background, but it doesn't seem to me that this offers any sort of solution. But if we're going to reduce everything to a discussion of tactics, when the strategic picture is going wrong, then it seems to me that we're not really learning the underlying lesson, which is that Ukraine cannot win this war.
Well, if you ask me whether we in the West, and this does not include us, but
no,
they're in the mainstream,
of course,
if you ask me whether we have a steep learning curve, the answer is no. The only interesting question is whether that learning curve is flat or it goes up a little bit. And I think the fact is that it is close to flat. I've watched the American national security establishment at work since the Cold War ended, and we've gone from one fiasco to another. It's truly amazing. The fact that hardly anybody seriously questioned whether this offensive would work is just hard to believe. And a really good example of this, Alexander, has to do with General Milley. As you know, Milley said last fall, after the Kherson and Kharkiv offensives were successful, that this is the time to cut a deal. Because Milley understood they were lucky, right, that they were dealing with an overextended Russian army at the time. They had two victories under the belt, right? But the situation was just going to get worse with time. So Milley was saying, cut a deal now. Milley was shut down immediately. Everybody told him that, you know, his comments were basically Russian propaganda, aiding the Russians, hurting the Ukrainians, and so forth and so on. And what he should do is act as a cheerleader. This is quite remarkable. And I don't see the situation fundamentally different today than it was back then. I hope I'm wrong. I mean, we really don't know what's going on behind closed doors. I mean, we can hypothesize what the battles look like, and we can make plausible arguments, but exactly how many people are acting in a commonsensical way is hard to say at this point. And I would note, by the way, it's certainly not going to include Biden, Jake Sullivan, and Tony Blinken. I mean, I think all three of them are basically hopeless on this front. But maybe someone like Bill Burns is speaking truth to power here. But who knows?
Yeah, I was curious because this, I guess one of the strengths of the West was supposed to be our openness, the ability of military leaders, academics, journalists to ask critical questions to get the best policies possible. And I guess it's been one of the problems that we either have, either be a cheerleader in your words or effectively be pushed aside and, you know, have your articles scraped from the internet. I saw this interesting interview by former president Nicolas Sarkozy, where he kind of hinted towards this, because he argued that it was a, you know, key mistake for the West to bet everything on defeating Russia in this offensive, simply saying we didn't have any plan B. If it doesn't work, no one even wanted to discuss the prospect of negotiating with the Russians. Again, this was what happened to him. He was also labeled a Putinist for pointing out his key weakness. But it kind of takes me where to go from here, because obviously the Russians are building up a big, powerful force in the rear. The Ukrainians tend to be falling a bit apart, and also the West were having some war fatigue, and also our weapon storages are empty. So where do we go from here? Because the way I see it, either we have to escalate in the form of more powerful weapons or striking deeper inside Russia or entering the war directly, or we have to start talking to Russia. But again, after a year of and a half of fighting, the possibilities which were in front of us in March and April of last year aren't really here anymore, I think. So it just seems Russia, Ukraine, they both see an existential threat. The West, we kind of gambled the entire liberal hegemonic order on this war. So what is the possibility of any political settlement coming out of this?
Let me just make a couple points, and I won't answer all your questions, which are terrific. And then you guys can come back at me and offer your opinions, and we can talk more about the issues I don't address. But I want to start by just emphasizing that it's important to note that Sarkozy was at the infamous April 2008 Bucharest NATO summit, where the decision was made to bring Ukraine into NATO. And Sarkozy and Merkel, she was the German leader at the time, he was the French leader, of course, both of them were adamantly opposed to bringing Ukraine into NATO because both of them understood what would happen. Just very important to understand that. So Sarkozy he saw the light in the beginning, right? And of course, what's happened to him is that he's been, in effect, smeared for speaking in a commonsensical way, which is what happens. Now, a couple points about where do we go from here. First of all, it's very important to understand that the West has no way of winning this war. And Ukraine has no way of winning this war. There's no magic formula here. You know, people talk about combined arms this and combined arms that, maneuver warfare. Oh, let's give them F-16s and ATACMs and those magical weapons will rescue the situation. This is all nonsense. There's no magical formula here that the West can apply. The interesting question to me is, what do you do if you're playing Russia's hand at this point in time? Right. If the West wants to negotiate, what are you willing to do? Do you accept the status quo on the ground or a slightly altered version of the status quo where you get all of Zaporizhia, all of the Donbass, and so forth and so on, that those areas are, you know, that those four oblasts that you now do not completely control. You get them, but that's it. That's the deal. And then you accept the fact that Ukraine may be part of NATO down the road, or that the relationship between NATO and Ukraine will remain intact. Is that a deal that you're willing to accept? I think the answer is no. I think if you're the Russians, you do not trust the West at all. You do not trust anything they say. And what you do is you try to get yourself into a position where you accept the fact that the tie, the link between NATO and Ukraine is not going to be broken. We're not going to walk away from this. And then the question is, how do you weaken Ukraine to where it's truly a dysfunctional rough state, and where your security, Russia's security, is maximized in the future? And I think from a Russian point of view, that means continuing the war. It means taking more territory. I think they want to take the four oblasts that are further to the west of the four oblasts that they've already annexed. I think the only way, and I'd be very curious to know what you folks think about this. I think the only way you can avoid that, and you can basically freeze the status quo on the ground, is if NATO and Ukraine agree to completely sever, and I'm choosing my words carefully here, completely sever the security relationship between the two sides. There is no more Western security commitment or security guarantee to Ukraine. There is no more possibility of Ukraine becoming a member of NATO. It's taken off the table. I think if you can convince the Russians that that is going to happen, then you may be able to freeze the situation on the ground and get some sort of peace agreement. But I don't see that happening. And that's why I think the Russians are incentivized to continue taking more territory. As Alexander often says on his show, every time the West says they're doubling down on bringing Ukraine into NATO, that gives the Russians greater incentive to destroy Ukraine. It's kind of crazy, but that's where we are. So I'd be curious to know what you folks think about those comments.
Very interesting, Gong. First of all, I think that the Russians probably, when I say the Russians, the Kremlin, Putin, the people around him, probably would be willing to begin a negotiation. I think that this isn't just because Putin is somebody who likes to negotiate, and he tends to see negotiation and diplomacy as an area where he's strong. But I think at some level, what he's concerned about, what he wants, is what the Russians want, is to assert an independent position in the world. They want Russia to be secure, but they also want it to be independent. They want it to be sovereign. So they don't want to cut themselves off completely from the West. If they can come to some kind of long-term, sustainable understanding with the West, then they would be open to a negotiation about Ukraine. But it would not just be about Ukraine. This is what I personally think. I think it would also have to extend, firstly, to the question of certainly no NATO membership for Ukraine. I think that is an absolute red line for the Russians. It has been ever since 2008. It has been that before 2008. Bill Burns said as much. But I think they will also want some guarantee that this whole situation won't repeat itself again in the future. And that means looking at the security arrangements in Europe. Now, they offered those two draft treaties in December 2021, going back before then, back in, I think it was in fact 2008, they made proposals about making the OSCE the leading security institution in Europe. They might be prepared to enter into substantive discussions about this, but it is going to be extremely difficult. And I have to say that might be something the Russians are prepared to do. I'm not convinced from everything I've seen and heard that the United States is, and some countries in Europe, and I'm sorry to say mine, Britain, I think would be strongly opposed to this. So this is, I'm answering a question now, but that's what I think.
But aren't you saying that the West is not going to be willing to sever its security relationship with Ukraine and therefore satisfy the Russians?
Well, I think they might conceivably say, right, well, we accept that Ukraine isn't going to join NATO anytime soon, which is what they've said before. But I don't think that's going to be enough to satisfy the Russians. I think if that's all we're prepared to say, and that for the moment, that's the only indication that we have that they're prepared to say anything, I think the Russians will say, no, that isn't enough. And if we offer Ukraine what we call security guarantees, which fall short of NATO membership, but which the Russians see again as perhaps an entry point for future NATO membership for Ukraine, the Russians will again say, sorry, that's not enough. We have to talk about NATO. We have to talk not just about Ukraine and NATO, but also the general way forward, a general security architecture, guarantees for our security on our Western borders, which is paramount to us. And I think you can understand where the Russians are coming from. 10 years ago, it would have been different if in Bucharest we'd not made that offer to Ukraine. Then, you know, they wouldn't probably have said that, you know, we're worried about the general security situation in Europe. If we'd implemented the Minsk agreements, which, of course, did not even mention NATO, as it's purely about internal domestic arrangements within Ukraine. It was not overtly about Ukraine's foreign policy alignments and commitments. But we didn't do that. We didn't persuade the Ukrainians that their interest lay in implementing the Minsk agreement. Because we didn't do those things. It's exactly what you said. Trust has collapsed. Even if we say no Ukraine in NATO, the Russians will come back and say, well, that's very good. We can perhaps agree a ceasefire and an armistice. But if we're going to have a long-term solution to this problem in Ukraine, a peace agreement, something we can be satisfied with and which will work for you. We need something more that addresses the security questions in Europe as well.
Yeah. If I can just make a quick point here. If you look at Putin's speeches, various speeches before February 24th, 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine, it's very clear that he sees Ukraine becoming a de facto member of NATO. Mm-hmm. And so when the Americans say, or the West says, that Ukraine is not going to become part of NATO in a formal sense, that may be true, but it's kind of meaningless, right? The fact is that Ukraine was, before the war, becoming a de facto, or was a de facto member of NATO. And there's a huge amount of evidence to support this, and Putin was pointing it out. And that tells me, given the lack of trust, that we have to completely sever our security ties with Ukraine. A number of my friends have said to me, listen, John, maybe what we can do here is say Ukraine will never become part of NATO, but that doesn't mean we can't continue to provide weapons to Ukraine and to train the Ukrainians. And my argument is this is a non-starter. This is not going to work, especially after what happened with the Minsk negotiations, where people like Angela Merkel and others have now admitted that they bamboozled the Russians, that they took Putin to the cleaners, as we used to say when I was a kid. So the Russians don't trust the West at all. So there has to be a complete severing of the security links. And I find it hard to imagine us doing that.